call a remote hearing of the Legacy Committee to order this morning. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us. And I'd like the clerk to take the roll, please. Mr. O'Neill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Lilly.
Lilly, present.
Representative Jordan.
Jordan, present.
Representative Green.
Present.
Representative Ackham.
Present.
Representative Anderson.
Anderson, present.
Representative Bowe. Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Hassan.
Present.
Representative Murphy. Representative Nelson.
Nelson, present.
Representative Erdahl. Representative Waslowick.
Present.
Representative Zhang. Mr. Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill, and we have a quorum, so we're open for business. Vice Chair Jordan, would you be willing to move our minutes from February 9th?
Yes, Mr. Chair, after reviewing the minutes, I move their approval from our meeting on February 9th, 2022.
Thank you, Vice Chair Jordan. Any questions regards to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? We have approved minutes. Thank you, Vice Chair Jordan. So, as all of you should know by now, we have four major work areas that we work in. And last week we started with the arts and trails, arts folks, and then we're going to have a day where we kind of focus on trails, and we're going to get into deeper in some of the other arts area with the culture. And then so today we're going to kind of focus on just kind of going through two of our bigger areas, the clean water fund area and then the outdoor heritage. And so we've invited the folks from the outdoor that work on the Lasard's Sam's group that works on the outdoor heritage area, and we've asked Mr. Johnson, the director Lasard Sam's, to come and kind of tell us where they're at and what they've been working on and what's going well and then what's going, you know, maybe not as well with COVID and just generally. And so we're excited to have you. And I've had an opportunity to look at a lot of your projects through, you know, reading about them and outdoor news and other things. And it seems like there's a lot of good work going on all over the state. But Mr. Johnson, Director Johnson, if you'd like to kick us off, that'd be great. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning to you and to all the members of the committee. It's wonderful to be here with you again, and I hope we can provide you with some really interesting information for you this morning and confirmative information too. With me this morning is Greg Hoke. He is the DNR's Prairie Habitat Supervisor, and he'll be kind of after I'm done here giving you some preliminary information. Mr. Hoke will capably lead us through some of the information regarding outdoor heritage work from a climate change aspect and resiliency aspect or standpoint, talking about the multiple benefits of the habitat work, as well as not just for fish and game and pollinators and wildlife, but also for clean water or for societal, you know, benefits as well. So that cross spectrum of benefits. But before I do that, I definitely want to give you some information and go through some of the COVID considerations and so on. First of all, just to kind of give you a picture of outdoor heritage funds. Remember, everything started with appropriations in 2009, June 30 or July 1st of 2009, those appropriations started to become effective and get out into the field. Since that time, there's been over $1.3 billion appropriated by the legislature for projects and programs. Mostly it's for programs, and that means that within each program, there are multiple projects and multiple a larger areas within each program too. So it's kind of a way that the council figured was a good way to make sure that the state as a whole got representation from a geographic standpoint for the money to be distributed. Since that time, also just completed projects, and there's always a bunch of projects in the hopper. So we it takes anywhere from 2 to 6 or 8 years for programs to be completed. And that's all the projects within the program. So just from our completed final reports of appropriations, there's been 1,187,903 acres have been either protected, restored, or enhanced across the state. So over almost 1.2 million acres. And that's the ones that are completed only in the final reports. There are other acres that have been completed but haven't been reported in their final report yet. I'm not going to try to extrapolate those because the number is always moving. So that's just kind of some background info. This whole presentation was prefaced by Chair Lilly chatting with me about how he had seen a couple of presentations to the council, to the Lisard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council, regarding climate change and how projects are resilient and affected by or doing carbon sequestration or whatever it might be. Those presentations were by Mr. Hoke, and then at one meeting, and then at another time by Neil Feakin with the Nature Conservancy. And Neil is not able to join us today, so maybe he'll be able to join the committee some other time and give you some further information that they've been finding. But before I get to Mr. Hoke, another couple of overviews for you. COVID has been a concern for everybody from a work standpoint, not just personal standpoint, but a work standpoint. And because of that, we've been noticing some trends, and it's been a couple of years now, really, of working closely with our project managers and working with others in talking with other groups to find out what's going on and how are people handling it. One thing we're finding is that for sure agencies had a bigger problem than NGOs, and I don't mean that lightly. It wasn't so much bigger a problem. It's just different because agencies had to deal with the governmental regulations more so than NGOs, nonprofit organizations, or smaller local governments local units of government. NGOs still were able to involve citizens because people wanted to get outside and do something. So there was opportunities for people to get out and help with habitat work, to attend seminars, to find out what's going on locally and still be involved in that special park or stream or local organization that they're really interested in. The agencies had a tougher time getting their people out because, you know, by the regulations, they'd have to have, if they had four people going, they had to have four cars to get them there. So it really slowed down some things. The NGOs who worked with agencies found it a little tougher to get agency people out to the site, again, because of some of those restrictions. So things slowed down some. Thankfully, legislatively, you all helped to provide some extensions to appropriations last year and the year prior, in the legislative session, so that people had a little more time to spend their dollars. And during that, now we've seen that the request for extensions has definitely dropped. We've been working with project managers or program managers to make sure that they have the adequate time and then to talk through those individual issues with them. Last year when we met at this time, there were some other questions that you all had, which I'd like to quickly go through because I think they're always pertinent, and we've done some things I think you're going to be very happy with. First of all, there was a question on how is the Outdoor Heritage Fund working to make sure that everybody gets a chance at these dollars? How are we including and incorporating BIPOC community considerations, et cetera? We took that very much to heart, went back and had kind of an internal review of what our process was for issuing our call for funding recommendations each spring. That goes out April 1st. The first thing we do is look at the call itself and look and how it was worded. We made some wording changes there. And then we looked at also the applications, and we added a question to our applications so that every application that came in had to answer this question: how will your program directly involve engagement and benefit BIPOC and diverse communities? And we got some really interesting answers and insightful answers. That was, it was pretty cool. It also made our program managers start thinking a little bit more about, are we really including everybody or not? And if we aren't, how can we expand that? And what we found also was that, some of them are, it's tough for them to engage the public because of the scope and the size. There was definitely consideration happening and further changes that will be coming about. The other thing we did was we made sure that our call for funding requests, we kind of ramped up or added some new factions to how we put it out to the public. So not only did we send it to our own listserv and our own media list that we have, our database of media for Lasard Sams, and that all includes TV, radio, printed media, small newspapers, online media outlets, et cetera. But we also hired a professional organization or hired their services to expand that and duplicate it to a large part, but that's okay, because if people get from more than one source, we figure that's a good thing. We also, through that, expanded our social media activity with regards to the putting out the call. And so not only our own Facebook and Instagram for Lasard Sams, but also through the professional services and their contacts in that whole area, their access to media and media type outlets online. We also sent it to the other legacy funds, asking them to share with their contacts if they would please. And we're willing to do that for them as well. And then there was a staff level thing where I just, myself and staff members personally, sent it to other organizations, made personal follow-up calls to those organizations. For instance, each one of the tribal entities in tribal authorities or bands in Minnesota, I personally sent them an email with the call explaining it and offering other assistance if they had questions. I followed that up with a personal phone call to the natural resource departments of every one of those entities so that we weren't missing somebody. And if there are questions or if it got thrown in the junk mail, there was an actual contact made. Great conversations and really, it's something I've done a lot of in the past, but this year we really pulled out the stops and made sure everything was done. And that started us on a new path of that communication. The other thing we did was I worked with, contacted and worked with Sia Herr with the Ethnic Council, and through got some feedback and information from her. She also asked her to forward it to her council contacts, and I believe she did that. So we're really appreciative of that. You know, those small ethnic, I'll call them ethnic newspapers, were added to our lists and to our contacts. So I don't know if you all remember, but last year, every senator and every representative got an email from me.
Yep.
And if it bounced back, then I went back and found another way to get it to them. But again, providing the call to you all, asking if each of you, every representative and senator, would forward that to their constituents who they thought might be interested, or constituent groups in their region, in their areas, and then offered, of course, further assistance. So I'd be glad to contact them myself if you just let me know who that is. And we did get some feedback from legislators asking us to send to this group, talk to this guy, call this person. So that was helpful. We try to do that every year, but this year, we pulled out those stops a little bit more and make sure it happened and followed it all up. We went to sent it to all the counties, the cities, and the townships even, to make sure that our local units of government, be it urban or rural, got the information. I went out to the executive director of the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. We also, just went everywhere that we could possibly think of. And that now is our normal, it will be our normal procedure as we move forward. It's been an interesting experience, an interesting exercise, because like before, but on a broader scale, I think, and a greater scale, we had communications with groups who said, well, I don't really think we're eligible. But as we sat and talked, then things came up. For instance, I had a wonderful conversation. I actually saw where the Historical Society had purchased, I think it was 40 or 80 acres and donated it to the Lower Indian Sioux community. So out of that article that I read, it was on NPR or something, I called out there, talked to the resource people, natural resource people, about, well, what are you going to do for restoration of that habitat on that property? Are you planning that, putting in native prairie or whatever? We had a great conversation that did not result in an application for a project this year or this last year, but it may this year. We're waiting to hear that. The Upper Indian Sioux community, we had a similar conversation through my phone calls back to the bands and the authorities. And that, it looks like, may provide an application for this spring, this April through March or April through May, when the call for funding request is open. So some cool things happening. You'll be hearing later when we do get to the bill, there's a daylighting of Phelan Creek is one project that is recommended by the council for funding. And you're probably, many of you are already familiar with that, but we'll talk about that. That's another one that kind of came as a really neat byproduct maybe, or result of the conversations that we had over the last year. And we're really proud of every one of those times we get a chance to talk to people and maybe open their eyes about the opportunities that avail to them. Let me just take a look at my notes here. I'm sure I'm missing a whole bunch of things. Another thing that came up last year was how we were collaborating. And last week, Representative Murphy was asking that question of other groups. So I wanted to make sure I hit that for you as well. But we definitely are collaborating with the other funds. From a standpoint, and it may be that, Outdoor Heritage is really the project collaborations is where our dollars, Outdoor Heritage dollars, not ours, Outdoor Heritage dollars, will be used for habitat. The clean water dollars are used for they have to focus on water quality, parks and trails in their area, and arts and culture heritage in theirs. You can't, arts and cultural heritage dollars, it doesn't make sense to spend those on habitat enhancement or restoration because there's Outdoor Heritage dollars for it. So let's do that. From a standpoint of the individual collaborations, on a regular basis, now it's pretty much every other month, at most every 3 months, but about every other month, and we've been doing this for a couple of years, I have regular meetings with the Clean Water Coordinator, Mr. Gardner, LCCMR Director Nash, and the Legislative Water Council Director, Jim Stark. And we're talking about, issues in conservation and how our dollars or how our activities maybe butt up against each other and help each other yoke. From a standpoint of parks and trails, there's all kinds of collaboration going with Outdoor Heritage dollars being used in parks, local parks, county parks, and state parks, where the Outdoor Heritage dollars are used for the restoration and enhancement of those. And then of course, parks takes care of the trails and other things. With arts and cultural heritage, it's more done on the local level and it's more after the project is completed or sometimes while the project is going, but it's after the project is completed, then the local groups can figure out how do we interact with this and then they can apply for arts and cultural heritage grants that can be used for teaching people about why this is culturally important to our area. And I've got examples of that up north as well as in the metro. I'm going to run out of time if I give all those. The clean water collaborations, they've been quite extensive. Representative Murphy mentioned about the St. Louis area, river area concern and that whole restoration of the estuary. That's a great example of outdoor heritage dollars, clean water dollars, all being used at the in that project. And now arts and cultural heritage dollars and parks and trails are starting to, are working into that area. Again, teaching about the cultural significance of the wild rice restoration, the lake bed restoration, so we can have fish and game populations starting to abound in there again. And then the trails going through that area that are, and the park aspects that are being employed by parks and trails. The Forest for the Future, the One Watershed, One Plan, this is with that's with Bowser, CREP. Critical shoreline protection, riparian buffers, those are all with where Bowser is using clean water monies and outdoor heritage funds collaboratively and very much with a cross benefits that are really important for us. So lots of stuff happening that is, I think you can be very proud of, and definitely we are. And Mr. Chair, so we have plenty of time. I'd like to shift over to Mr. Hoke now, if that's okay, and let him go through that presentation, and we'll stand for questions for you.
Thank you, Director Johnson. I just really want to respect you and the council for, you know, kind of hearing what we were talking about last year in the legislature and really making an effort. It was neat to hear that, their outreach. And like you said, it may not yield a project this year, but it lays a base and puts it in their mind and maybe down in the, into the future. Listening to Chair Murphy and hearing her, the joint collaboration is a big thing. It's been for me too, as well. And I know you know that, and I know you're trying. I've seen some amazing projects, with the Bowser, and, it ends up, there was just one I was reading last week. I was going to bring it in, but I forgot it this morning. But it had, great hunting habitat. But it's working with a willing farmer, and it's with you, Clean Water, and Lessard Sands. Just a fantastic project, preserving and protecting habitat. And just, I'll try to get that out to members. So, Director Johnson, I'm going to move on to Mr. Hoke from the DNR. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. Go ahead when you're ready, sir. Please introduce yourself.
Yes, Chairman. Thank you for the introduction today. I've been having all sorts of email problems or computer problems this morning. So let me know when you can see my screen.
I think we're good.
Okay.
Sharing's working. Yep.
Okay. Thank you for the invitation this morning. My name is Greg Hoke, the Prairie Habitat Supervisor at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I gave a talk on ecosystem services, which is kind of a wonky term, to the council about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And then Neil Feakin and I gave a talk last year, specifically on climate change and carbon. I basically just kind of squished those two presentations together with some heavy editing for this morning. But basically what I want to talk today about is the Outdoor Heritage Fund, kind of in a non-traditional way. When we think about the outdoors, we think about hunting, things like that. We can really tell now a much larger story far beyond that. And so what I want to do today is talk really about two different parts. The first is climate change directly, how natural lands are able to capture and sequester or store carbon. And then also the role these lands play in creating a more resilient landscape in the context of the changes we're seeing and future changes, such as some of the heavy rainfall events we've been seeing in recent years. Oops. Here's just a real quick diagram of the carbon cycle and as it relates to habitat work. So everybody's probably having flashbacks to their high school or college biology class right now. The way carbon cycles through the atmosphere, basically with respiration or combustion of fossil fuels, we add carbon to the atmosphere through the process of photosynthesis. plants remove carbon from the atmosphere and either store it in the vegetation or the soil. What I'm going to talk about today is a little different than the normal climate talks. Usually when we talk about climate change, we're talking about over here this up arrow, making this up arrow kind of cartoonish diagrammatically showing a large arrow, putting a large amount of carbon into the atmosphere and trying to reduce that. So putting less carbon into the atmosphere, making our cars more fuel efficient, making our energy production more fuel efficient. What I want to talk about today is actually these two arrows kind of going in the opposite direction, where basically we can use natural processes, photosynthesis and others, and basically instead of adding less carbon to the air, we're going to pull more carbon out of the air. So kind of working in a different way than what we normally think about when we think about climate mitigation. Okay, habitat restoration. Mark talked a lot about all the habitat we've been able to restore, grassland, wetland, forest, et cetera. This is a great way to really capture what I will call new carbon. That's maybe not the best way to say it, but additional carbon. A study from 2008 talking about tallgrass prairie vegetation has a potential to sequester relatively large amounts of carbon in the soil over a sustained period of time. And I'll stop right here for a second and say that I'm the prairie person. I'm going to use primarily prairie examples. From a climate change perspective, carbon is, or forestry is well understood. Plant a tree for tomorrow. However, prairies are not as well understood or advertised from a climate change perspective. So I'm going to really focus on that. However, with the caveat that basically everything I'm going to say about prairies today is applicable to both forests and wetlands also. Relative to this particular slide, I know there were some studies going back to the 1930s in Nebraska. John Weaver, one of the godfathers of prairie research, what they showed is 3 years after a prairie was restored, they found over 5.5 tons of roots per acre in that restoration. And so start multiplying that over large acreages, and we're talking about a lot of roots and a lot of carbon in those roots. The storyline. The historic storyline has been grasslands are about pheasants, about pheasant hunters, et cetera, et cetera. We'll call that the 1950s model. But even moving to the modern day, we can tell a really simple story that grasslands, forests, wetlands, and peatlands absorb and store large amounts of carbon. With our protection efforts, as you'll know, where our activities are pretty much broken into restore, protect, enhance. So with our protection efforts, we're keeping that carbon in the soil and in the vegetation. And with our restoration efforts, we're adding carbon to the vegetation in the soils. However, and this is what I'll talk about in the next couple slides, we can actually tell even a much more complex story than that. Grasslands, forests, wetlands, peatlands provide a host of other benefits for both wildlife and people. Now, when you read the literature about this, we talk about resiliency, we talked about stacked benefits, we talk about ecosystem services. Those are all basically different ways of saying the same thing. There are additional benefits to habitat work, protection, restoration, and enhancement, in addition to just producing more birds, more butterflies. Grasslands and wetlands capture a large amount of water and minimize runoff. Again, some studies from back in the 1940s and 50s in Nebraska, where the grass is a lot shorter, they were able to show that in a rainstorm, just on the droplets of water that are held on the leaves, grasslands can capture 12,000 gallons per acre. That's water that's just standing there. It's going to evaporate or slowly trickle down and soak into the soil. The two pictures below here, these are a couple pictures from, I used to live just west of Mankato. This is one of those 7-inch rainstorms we had a few years ago. This is the field behind my house. Pretty substantial runoff on that field. There's a creek just to the left or just to the right of this picture. That creek bounced about 9 feet in a couple of hours. So it increased 9 feet in just a few hours. The picture on the right there is a public land. This happens to be actually a federal waterfowl production area. That's just a mile east of the picture here of all the water running off the field. In the wetlands within this natural lands, the water just sat there. There was no runoff. The water sat there. It provided some duck habitat. Eventually, it soaked into the ground and recharged the aquifer. Grasslands and wetlands are also great at filtering water. So if you look at the furnace filter every month when you're changing it, and you look at this picture, a close-up of some grass, it looks pretty similar. And grasses and wetlands fill that exact same role. They filter both chemicals and sediment. So the two pictures here, this is the Jordan boat ramp. A fair amount of sediment there along the Minnesota River. This again is right after one of those fairly significant rainstorms and the resultant flooding. The picture on the left there is Lake Manitoba. Some of the algal blooms were seen up in Lake Manitoba. A lot of that's coming from the Red River up in the northwest part of the state. And we do unfortunately have some lakes and streams in Minnesota that look like this. One Outdoor Heritage Fund project from just west of Windham. This is a one-time grab sample, so we can't take too much from it, but the published literature really supports this. Using Outdoor Heritage Fund, we acquired the land, we restored the land, and we restored a pretty good-sized wetland on that land. We went in and did a one-time grab sample of water coming into that natural land and water going out of that wetland. And there was a 98.4% reduction in the nitrates in that water. So no chemical, not a lot of engineering. We just restored some wetlands and we reduced nitrate concentrations by 98%. Habitat and health. This is the 2015 Minnesota Drinking Water Report. Over here on the right-hand side, this is the Worthington Wells Project. This is the city of Worthington was having a drinking water issue. They didn't try to re-engineer, do a lot of things. They went out and identified where the critical soils were on their wellhead protection area and their drinking water supply management area, acquired those lands, restored them to grassland, and then basically flip those to both the DNR and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to manage in the long term. Again, not a huge amount of engineering, a lot of expenses. They basically just restored natural lands to solve their drinking water issues. Diversity, pollinators, and carbon. So for the last decade plus, we've been using really high diversity seed mixes. If you go back 20 years, you look at some of our WMA restorations, we used a couple species of grasses and a handful of wildflower seeds in our restorations. And you look at them today and there aren't a lot of flowers out there. The restorations we've been doing for the past 5-10 years, we're sometimes using 40, 60, 80 species of wildflowers in those restorations that we're doing with the Outdoor Heritage Fund. So we've been doing that primarily for wildlife generally and pollinators specifically. Then there have been a couple of studies that have come out of the Cedar Creek Natural History Area up in East Bethel, just north of the Twin Cities. And what they have found is that by using high diversity seed mixes, in addition to providing a lot of resources for pollinators, that's also the best strategy for maximizing the amount of carbon that you can capture in both the roots and the soils. So we've been doing, using a practice to do one thing, and lo and behold, that same practice is really beneficial for something else, specifically pollinator habitat and carbon storage and sequestration. Outdoor Heritage Fund's efforts to date, and these are some numbers that Mark Johnson and Joe Pavelka were able to provide for me just yesterday. So these are the acres of wetlands, prairie, and forest that have been protected and restored basically since 2009 up to last year. I used a calculator, a carbon calculator that the Nature Conservancy has developed to figure out on a one-year basis the total amount of the metric tons, MT, of carbon dioxide that have been pulled out of the atmosphere. And then I was able to go on an EPA website and figure out that that's about 9.5 million vehicles per year equivalent. So it's basically the effect of taking 9.5 million vehicles off the road each year from a carbon emissions perspective. Then I wanted to talk for just a minute or so about some of kind of how the Outdoor Heritage Fund fits into some of the larger picture, some of the issues that the legislature will be dealing with this session. So there's the Additional Natural Lands Initiative, from the Walz Flanagan budget to move Minnesota forward. And this is money that that was in for the DNR, the 22 supplemental budget for the climate adaptation and mitigation. And within there's $81.5 million for investments in the DNR. And you can see how those are split out in the right-hand side here. So $24 million for public lands acquisition and restoration, another $10 million to go in and look at our current WMAs, find out where we've got some of those low diversity areas, again, some of those older restorations, and let's go in there and get those really jazzed up with some really high quality seed mixes and increase our ability of our existing WMAs to capture carbon even more so. And then there's the Climate Action Framework. And that Climate Action Framework is really being led by Bowser, Department of Ag, the DNR, and the PCA. And there are really five components of that: clean transportation, climate smart natural and working lands, resilient communities, healthy lives and communities, and the clean economy. I've been very involved with the climate smart natural and working lands. And again, we're talking about habitat and how habitat benefits not only the ducks, the pheasants, the deer, but how it really benefits all of us. So a healthy natural lands and healthy natural working lands absorb and store more carbon, produce food and other products, sustain local economies, enhance climate resiliency, and improve the quality for all Minnesotans. One issue that comes up frequently when people are talking about this issue in general is doing good work in the right geography. And the way I've kind of tried to oversimplify this perhaps is saying we shouldn't be restoring grasslands up in Grand Marais, nor should we be planting a lot of forest down in Luverne. We do have maps. We've got the Marshner map. We know what the historic vegetation was. We should really listen to Mother Nature when it comes to a lot of our habitat work. And again, do the right type of habitat work in the right part of the state on the right types of soils. Okay. Talking to other people, some people are telling me, you know, it's an either or situation. You can have habitat or you can have carbon sequestration. And it's not an either or, it's an and. So traditionally, when we talk about habitat, we talk about wildlife conservation, pheasants, songbirds, et cetera, et cetera. Habitat restoration and protection benefits wildlife, and we can control runoff, we can reduce the economic and emotional costs of flooding, we can recharge groundwater, we can protect wellheads, both for cities and landowners, we can filter sediment, we can filter nitrates, we can keep our drinking water safer for infants and others. We can provide lots of recreational and working lands, which are going to be big benefits to those local economies. And we can use those lands to play a leading role in climate change. Again, both directly by removing carbon from the atmosphere and again, creating a more resilient landscape to adapt to some of those changes, like those heavy rainfalls. Okay, so with the Outdoor Heritage Fund, we're already doing good things, but by kind of expanding the story, we can tell a more diverse and more robust story. So outdoor heritage projects have been storing carbon all along. We just really haven't been talking about that. And so what this does is it gives us a new, more diverse storyline to take our message to a much larger audience. Whether I want to talk about wildlife, pollinators, water, carbon, et cetera, I can have a couple of different slides at the front of my presentation, but the body of my presentation can be pretty similar because by doing these few actions, we can have a large number of benefits to a large number of people and species. And with that, Mark and I will be happy to take any of your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hoke. What a fantastic presentation. So I have a couple of questions from members. I'd like to certainly respect them, and maybe I'll have them pop in now. I know you have one more presenter, Mr. Pavenko. Mr. Green, Representative Green, are you ready? Go ahead, sir.
I'm driving, Mr. Chair, and I didn't realize, excuse me, you had another presenter. I will gladly wait until all the presenters are done. I think that would be most beneficial.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Representative Green. Drive safe. That's I'm impressed. Be safe. Representative Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. I can wait as well. Or if I had a question for Mr. Hoke, but I can wait too until the last presenter is finished.
Okay. Well, if it's pertinent to Mr. Johnson, you had your hand up.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Pavelko is just here for added help if answering questions or anything. So.
Oh, okay. So
our presentation is done.
Okay, I misunderstood. So maybe we'll start with Representative Anderson, and then we'll have Representative Green, you know, be able to pull over and get in a good safe spot. Representative Anderson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Mr. Hoke of the DNR, you saw in the slide you presented additional funding to the DNR to reduce CO2 in the air. Well, I live fairly close to a state park out in western Minnesota, probably 4 or 5 miles away. And every spring, like clockwork, a nice spring day, when the wind isn't too high, look down to my south and there's billowing white smoke in the air. And it's the DNR burning off the state park in a controlled burn. And I've often thought about the amount of CO2 given off in these controlled burn type things. So is reducing the incidence of controlled burns one of the things you're looking at in terms of reducing CO2 in the air?
Thank you, Representative, for the question. The science is still out on this as far as the details. So what I'm going to say, I'm going to speak in generalities. So what you're seeing when you see that big smoke plume, first off, a lot of what you're seeing is actually water vapor, not carbon coming off. But we are all, I will admit, we are volatilizing a lot of carbon and adding a big chunk of carbon to the atmosphere at once. However, what we think is happening is burning stimulates the growth so much, especially the summer after, as well as the next couple of years. If you look at the total carbon budget over the following summer, and again, the next year or two, we may actually be in the long term pulling more carbon out of the atmosphere, even though we do have that kind of one day or a couple hour pulse of carbon into the atmosphere. But again, the details on the science of that, the scientific community is still working through. It looks dramatic, but it may not be. Now, the caveat to that question would be, that's a grassland situation where those plants are regrowing very quickly. We don't know in the scientific community, for instance, some of those massive wildfires out in California, up in Manitoba. I know this year, I live just north of Cambridge. There were a number of days last summer where my eyes were burning and stinging when I went out because of the smoke. We don't know that, you know, that may be contributing more because those forests are not going to regrow in a year or two. So I am not a forester, so I can't speak to that in detail. But that is something that the scientific community is still trying to tease apart the exact details and the exact balance there.
Representative Anderson.
Yeah, one more follow-up. I appreciate that answer, Mr. Hoke. You also mentioned when discussing the benefits of grasslands, and I fully agree that grasslands do a great job of sequestering carbon. But back a few years ago, when the buffer bill was a hot topic here in Minnesota, and discussing the benefits of buffers and such, there was a study that somebody found up in Canada. And what the study seemed to show was that when the grasslands or the grass buffer strips up there in the fall dried up and began to decay, they actually released more nitrogen than what they thought they sequestered during the summer from being a filter strip. Do you have any research on that in terms of when the grasslands dry up in the fall and decay in the release of nitrates or nitrogen?
Thank you for the question. I am not familiar with that study. I do know, I did a lot of my research down in Kansas, the research I've seen is that nitrogen breaks down fairly slowly. I will circle back with some of my colleagues at Bowser and see if they're familiar with that study, and we'll look into that, and if we can find something out, we'll try to get something back to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Green, are you in a place where you can?
As long as my road noise doesn't get you, I think I can move forward. So I'm going to touch off on Representative Anderson's question, if that's all right, Mr. Chair.
Sounds great. Go ahead, Representative Green.
Okay, to the DNR testifier, that was part of my question too. Was on the decay of the grasslands, especially next to the rivers, because I'm very surprised and disappointed that you haven't read that study, because it's been out for some time. And it's more than just nitrogen, it's also phosphates that are in this decaying grass. And the study shows, and it is very, seems to be very credible, that in the northern regions, not, you know, it could be different down south where you did your study, but in the northern regions, when this ground is froze and we have the spring runoff, all these nitrates and phosphates end up right in our rivers and waters, because they can't go into the soil. And in some cases that there would be more benefit to doing a conservation tillage on some of these properties where we know that there's a tremendous amount of runoff next to the rivers. And so I really hope that you'll look into that, because in all the efforts and all the money that we spend trying to solve this so-called problem, when we could be maybe adding to that problem. But the other issue that I have to talk about, and I'll be bringing this up again, so if you don't have the answers to these, hopefully you'll get them when we bring the bill before us. And you answered in the first question from Representative Anderson about my question as to what is more beneficial, the new growth or the old growth. And I think you answered that when you talked about how you get more benefit after a burn than you do than what goes into the air. And so when you have these old growth that is there for years, and there's all kinds of dead grass that even the new growth has to fight through to come through in the spring. If you've been in the prairie region where I go quite often, you'll see this. We could be causing more problems. I'd like to know two things. First of all, do you take that into consideration when you're talking about old growth? The other part of it is that you restored these things with the prairie grasses, but that doesn't mean there was nothing there before. So when you're gauging your carbon sequester, are you taking into account that there was benefit there before? And giving us, are you giving us the difference in the benefit, or are you just saying we're taking this much out now, regardless of what was taken out before?
Thank you for the question. I'm going to have to talk to my friends at Bowser and get into that that study you're referencing. I'm sure they will be familiar with it. From as far as the thatch or the detritus that's out there, generally that breaks down after about 4 years anyway. So a prairie that's unburned, you know, it's been 4 years since it's been burned and 14 since it's been burned, will probably have about the same amount of thatch out there. So that's not going to change too terribly much. There are other experts on the carbon calculator that I've used. And as far as exactly how they develop that, I am not the expert to talk on that. But Mr. Johnson could get those folks to this committee, and kind of if you're interested, go through the details of you know, what went into those formulas and calculations.
Representative Green.
Yes, that'd be very helpful. I'd like that very much. But and then my point on the other part of it was that if for say this was in cropland and you've got new growth every year, all summer long, you have the new growth coming up, there's a tremendous amount of benefit there. In fact, you know, I don't want to keep going through study and study, but I've read quite a bit on this, and it sounds like one of the best crops that we have out there for clean air is corn, and we may be even getting as much off of our corn as they're getting off of the rainforest. That doesn't sound feasible, but that's what these studies are saying. So I think we need to look into that. And then also, just to make a point, everything that you see, including you, is carbon-based. And so to believe that somehow we're going to eliminate carbon is a pipe dream. And the other thing is, if we did, you're not going to have any plants growing. So I think we need to, you know, use our head on some of this stuff. I know there's some good projects out there, but I'd like all the facts. And like I said, I look forward to the day when we sit down to go through the bill on some of the stuff that Mr. Johnson brought up. And I'm hoping that, Mr. Chair, that we can put aside a little more time this year so we have time to go through these projects. You know, some of these, I think we're in phase 15 or 16 or something like that. And so I would really like to know where we're going on some of these projects and what the end goal is. So if we have time to do that as we go further, that would be great.
Thank you, Representative Green. And do you have additional questions, or is that kind of?
That's kind of it for now. Like I said, I've, yep. I've got some issues going on, so I wish that I'd been at my desk, but that just wasn't possible today.
Well, thank you, Representative Green. And yes, that's our intent, is to hopefully have some more time, you know, when the bill that's coming forward from Lessard Sam, so we can kind of look at it. That's the nice thing about this second year of the biennium, to it gives us opportunities to take a peek and see what we can, you know, take a look at it. Just so all members know, Mr. Johnson's been nice enough to send out a book of all the projects that are currently that have passed or been proposed, and kind of the work orders. Lead Green has a copy, and I have a copy. And if anybody wants a copy on the committee, I can drop it at your office or on the House floor and get it to you, and you can take a look at it and study it. There's it's pretty thick. I have it at home right now, and again, Mr. Johnson's available for questions, I know, at any time. Vice Chair Jordan, I see you have a question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Johnson, for, a year ago, I asked you about what you were doing to reach out to new and diverse voices. And I do really want to thank you for taking that charge from this committee seriously. It was really heartening to hear the changes and the true deliberation in what is going on to make sure that we're reaching, that all Minnesotans have access to their outdoor heritage, because it is really something that belongs to every single Minnesotan. So first of all, I really want to thank you for the work that you've done this year and for really taking this seriously. I was wondering, and you talked a little bit about some of the challenges that you faced as well, but I was hoping you could, I was just hoping we could hear a little bit about some of the new groups that you've worked with, or some of the new projects that you're particularly proud of, or that would be of interest to the community. Are there any success stories that you can share as a result of some of the changes we've done in recruitment and outreach?
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I can bring up a couple of them for you if you'd like. I mentioned you'll be seeing that Lower Phelan Creek project in the proposal this year in the bill. That's one that was, it precipitated from I had a call with Maggie Lorenz, who is the executive director of Lower Failing Creek Project and the director for the Waukon Teepee Center. And the reason we talked was because I was just kind of calling to meet her and converse a little bit. I talked to the chair about Waukon Teepee, which I was not aware of that center before. And so we started chatting about their needs down there, because they're doing some habitat work and they're doing some grounds work and whatever, and trying to figure out, is there a way for outdoor heritage funds or the smaller CPL grants to be, apply there. And then I found out, well, they're looking at some daylighting of Failing Creek up through that Sweet Hollow and from Lake Failing on down. And so we started chatting about that. And then she brought in her natural resource people, and it just was such a cool development. I mean, from a conversational standpoint, I couldn't ask for anything better. It was just really a neat experience. Some of the other things, just there this year also in the project, the Minnesota Trout Unlimited is looking at, has a Metro and North Shore trout stream rehabilitation thing going on, project. And what they're looking at is, within that, they're looking at doing new hiring of basically young conservationists, looking at recruiting those people from Metro and BIPOC communities to give them that hands-on, firsthand, hands-on, in your face, right in the middle of conservation, so they can actually feel and see and learn what's going on and get paid for it at the same time. That came as a result of really asking that question about, and your questions last year, and then chatting with John Lucheski with Minnesota Trout Unlimited, and him looking at new ways to get things done. So it was another really neat deal. Beyond that, we're looking at other collaboratives that have been happening because groups are reaching out. One which seems like it's a stretch at first, but it's not, is the Camp Karen Parsons, which is started in 1956, and it provides low-income youth from North Minneapolis outdoor education opportunities as a day camp. It's within, I think it's an hour and a half of the city's of Minneapolis, out in Carver County on Oak Lake. And the Minnesota Land Trust was able to help them put an Outdoor Heritage Fund conservation easement on that property. Those easement dollars then are going into their trust to allow them to continue to keep that property protected, but also to keep using that property. And there's been other instances like that too. I'll use up everybody else's time if I keep going, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Vice Chair Jordan, great question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Johnson, for that answer. I really want to thank also Representative Zhang for his leadership on the Waukon Teepee and the Lower Failing Creek project. He's been a huge voice for that. So I'm glad that we were able to fund that through multiple funds. Thank you.
Thank you. So so I think we're at a good point. Mr. Johnson and Mr. Hoke, great presentation. Thank you for joining us this morning. 9 million cars or something. That was kind of sticks in my mind. That's amazing. But thank you for joining us. And I know you're available for questions, and thank you for that. And we look forward to further conversations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been our pleasure.
Thank you. So we're gonna switch gears here now, and we have Administrator Gardner. Welcome, and I don't know if you're are you?
I'm here, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Good.
Thank
okay.
you.
So go ahead and introduce yourself, and we're going to switch over to the Clean Water Fund area. Thank you. Go ahead.
Great. Just checking that my audio works, Mr. Chair.
Sounds great, sir.
Great. I haven't worn a coat or tie for some time, and so I decided to wear my formal headphones today. It's actually to help filter out the dog if he barks if the UPS guy comes. That's where we are these days. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Gardner. I'm the administrator for the Clean Water Council. And I was asked if I could, on behalf of many different entities, including state agencies, just give a breezy overview of things funded by the Clean Water Fund in 2021 since the end of last session. I've clocked this out at about 20 minutes or a little more than that. So if you ever need to give me the timeout to get up to your hard stop time, let me know. And I'm happy to answer questions today or next week or anytime.
Sounds great. We have to be done at the top of the hour and then like some time for questions. But
very good.
Thank you.
Well, I'll get right into it then. You're familiar with the Clean Water Council, so I'll save a couple minutes right there. This is going to be a trip a little bit like a glider over the state for about 20 minutes. Enjoy. I know you could relax a little bit. I know everyone was poring over maps yesterday, so you might be a little stressed out. I don't know. 2021 was not necessarily the year of COVID when it came to clean water. It was the year of drought. And I wanted to highlight a couple of examples where the drought was both a challenge and an opportunity for focusing on clean water. First, very low water levels allowed the MPCA to test to see if the permits for a lot of wastewater treatment plants are actually protective of water quality standards, even when flows are very low. They were also able to look at biological monitoring stations at 60 sites in the state to determine what sort of stressors were involved on aquatic life during low water. The PCA, when we are dealing with more precipitation, now has a climate data viewer tool. So you can actually look at factors that we expect to change due to climate change. So we're looking at drought as well as high water. There are some programs that the Clean Water Fund has supported for many years, which in a drought actually have gotten a little bit more focus because they're quite timely. The Met Council receives two appropriations from the legislature in most years. One is for the Metropolitan Area Water Supply Sustainability Support Program. This helps businesses and other institutions figure out how to use water more efficiently without hindering their activities. And that saves about 100 million gallons of water, groundwater a year. The Met Council also received a grant to get them sporadically to help cities make grants. It's a competitive grant to cities to give rebates to residents to be able to upgrade outdated water fixtures, appliances, and irrigation controllers, like you see on the right. The city of Woodbury has used this program for many years, and the average savings they get per house for upgrading an out-of-date irrigation controller is about 30,000 gallons a year. So that program is saving 500 million gallons of water a year in the metro. The reason that the Met Council does this is for two reasons. One is to allow enough groundwater resources for the metro area to grow over time. We are definitely not Phoenix or Tucson or Los Angeles, but we want to be prudent with our resources. And groundwater also interacts with surface water. So if groundwater levels are too low, that can infect water levels on surface waters. There are also some programs that are often in the background, which come to the foreground when there's a crisis. The drought was a crisis for many. The Clean Water Fund has supported DNR's efforts to monitor stream flow, as well as groundwater supplies around the state. They have more than 1,100 drinking water supply wells around the state, which serve as kind of an early warning network to see if there's going to be any problem with groundwater as a drinking water source. They have stream flow gauges around the state. This data was available on a weekly basis, so water suppliers like cities could have the up-to-date information they needed to make decisions about whether to ration water, put in sprinkling restrictions, and the like. So good data allowed for better decisions. And then that data also helps us understand hydrologic change generally in each watershed so that we can make good decisions. I wanted to mention an area where we're almost complete. This isn't drought related, but the MPCA encapsulates all of the science that's paid for by various sources, including the Clean Water Fund, about each of the 80 major watersheds in the state. This is how we do planning. So they put together a watershed restoration and protection strategy for each watershed or a RAPS. This is what I call a blueprint for what we need to do to get all waters in that watershed to meet water quality goals. You can't really build a house without a blueprint, so that's what that is. It serves as a basis for the comprehensive plans that Bowser works on with local units of government to prioritize which projects on those to-do lists are going to get done first. It's a little bit like you want to pour the foundation before you build the roof, obviously. When those wraps are done, the state also produces a TMDL report, a total maximum daily load report, which indicates how much of a certain contaminant like phosphorus or nitrogen is acceptable in a body of water to meet water quality standards, and we submit those to EPA. Not particularly flashy, but if you don't know what goal you're trying to meet, it doesn't make a lot of sense to spend money on a particular project. The St. Louis area, or St. Louis River area of concern was brought up. The 20 miles from the harbor in Duluth upstream was affected by more than a century of industrial pollution. The MPCA's capacity to manage that project is supported by the Clean Water Fund. They've been very skilled at then being able to do the planning to bring in state bonding dollars. The state has been very generous with that. Thank you. And that has also attracted a Great Lakes Restoration Initiative funding from the federal government. And there is more money coming from the federal government for Great Lakes funding, which is great news. So I think the leverage here is something like $1 in clean water funds brings in, I want to say, $36 in other funding sources. But all the construction projects on the Minnesota side of the border are on track to be complete by 2025. There are other procedures that have to go in place before the area could be delisted. But the big construction stuff will be done soon. Let's see. One of the allowable uses of the Clean Water Fund in the statutes 114D is enhanced compliance. We do have rules and permits and regulations for water, but there are cases where we can actually do more than what's just required or give the ability of local governments to actually enforce what's in a regulation through the Clean Water Fund. An example is funding given to counties to enhance inspection of septic systems that's supplemental to existing funding. That has resulted in a septic system compliance of more than 80%. We were around 50% before the Clean Water Fund. In terms of equity, this is an important consideration. Low-income households qualify for state clean water funds to replace a septic system if they can't afford it. They have to apply for that, but 215 systems were replaced, as I understand it, in 2021. And I want to say roughly 800 over the course of the whole program. In some cases, the septic system cost is greater than the value of the property itself. We do have a stringent wastewater regulation. One of the innovative ways that the MPCA is looking at helping cities have their wastewater treatment plants be in compliance with their permit is water credit trading. It's not unlike a cap and trade system for air emissions, except it's for water. In some cases, a wastewater treatment plant might find they have to reduce phosphorus by a relatively small amount, but it might cost millions of dollars or tens of millions of dollars in some cases. And it might actually be cheaper if they were to support landowners upstream, such as farmers, to install best management practices that reduce runoff and reduce phosphorus by roughly an equal amount. They're kind of complex transactions that require reliable data, which is why monitoring is so important, as well as verifying that those reductions take place. The Red River is one area where there's interest in combining all of these efforts to look at the basin as a whole instead of everyone going in silos, city by city by city, or farm by farm by farm. And that's actually going to probably save a lot of money and get us closer to where we need to be. And our Canadian friends will probably be happy about that. Cities also need a stormwater permit. That's in legislation that they require a permit, what we call an MS4 permit. But there's a new permit out, which has a lot of new requirements in it, particularly around the use of chloride, which is a big contaminant. And so there are things as simple as enhanced street sweeping techniques and stormwater pond management that some cities may not be aware of. And so the Clean Water Fund supports the PCA's capacity to do the outreach to the city so that they know how to comply and get to a level of excellence. Technical assistance is another key use of the Clean Water Fund. In 2021, a project here was completed in Anoka County to restore a stream that feeds into Coon Creek Watershed District and eventually into the Mississippi River. DNR's contribution from the Clean Water Fund tends to be in expertise, so ecologists and hydrologists assisted the Watershed District on the design of this restoration. The creek had been channelized to help get water off of fields, and now that it's surrounded by suburbia, it's possible to re-meander the stream to slow the water down and to reduce the amount of erosion, sediment, and phosphorus that goes downstream. The DNR actually got an award from the Coon Creek Watershed District for their design work, and they want to apply this method elsewhere. Just to give you an idea here, this has happened in my area in the suburbs in Ramsey County also. So you see where the creek had been channelized, and then the DNR and the Watershed District helped dig those oxbow bends that you see on the side, and then eventually connected them and re-meandered the stream. So this is a phenomenal recreational asset as well, but this is reducing the amount of phosphorus in them by the hundreds of pounds a year. And 1 pound of phosphorus can result in 500 pounds of algae. So that's why it's important. The PCA uses the Clean Water Fund for technical assistance to local units of government and the private sector through its Smart Salting Education Program. This has been one of the most popular programs that we have, actually. And more than 1,000 people took this class, several classes over the course of the year. These are folks from public works departments with snow removal trucks to snow removal contractors that are landscape companies in the summer, and they remove snow off of parking lots in the winter. It's been very effective, and it helps communities save money because we're actually using too much salt in many cases, and that's bad, particularly in the metro. Chloride can also show up in our surface waters through wastewater effluent. That's usually because of inefficient water softeners. Things like old timed water softeners in our homes are very wasteful compared to on-demand water softeners. And so the Clean Water Fund supported chloride reduction grants to three communities that you see listed here in Winona, Stearns, and Hennepin County to help people reduce how much chloride gets wasted through water softening. The Department of Ag is very skilled at technical assistance, working directly with producers and landowners. This is a program I'm sure Representative Anderson is very familiar with. I believe he's a certified farmer. But the program I get the most questions about from my colleagues in other states is this one, the Minnesota Agricultural Water Quality Certification Program, because it's one way to validate best practices on a variety of levels in one place so that you know a farmer is doing everything they can to protect water quality. Since the end of session, I told Ag that it was the end of May, but you met until June. But 143 farms were certified just in that time in the last 7 or 8 months with 92,000 acres certified. As I'm sure Representative Anderson can attest, it is not an easy A. It is quite rigorous, and there's an outside evaluator that helps recognize what you're already doing and helps you do some additional things to get the points you need to get certified. So right now we're at over 1,100 producers around the state who are certified at 18,000 acres. That number changes just about every week. The governor set a goal of having 1 million acres certified by the end of 2022, and we seem to be on track to get there. The good news about this program is we can document that farms get an average or up to 49% reduction in nitrogen application, which is what we want. They also, one study has shown every year that certified farms make more money. We were delayed by COVID in employing local advisory teams to communities where nitrate levels are too high in their public water supply wells. The groundwater protection rule, which went into place 2 years ago, has a triage of responses if wells are seen to have levels of nitrogen or nitrate that are too high. And there's a couple of voluntary steps that happen before regulation might kick in. And some of those methods are already going in. So this is the easy part, the carrot, meeting with experts and landowners to talk about how they can reduce the amount of nitrogen applied within what we call a drinking water supply management area, that zone around a wellhead to help be protective of drinking water. We also support an extension specialist through the Department of Ag at the University of Minnesota who's an irrigation specialist, and she's presented to us a few times, and she's really amazing and dynamic. She has helped farmers, crop advisors, and local partners figure out how to apply the right amount of water, which is good, especially when you're in a drought, but also optimal nitrogen application, because that's mixed with the water that shoots out over the crop. And of course, the very popular program Forever Green, which encourages the or develops crops that can be in the fields year-round, such as kernza or hazelnut is all the rage these days. That is perennial cover and can help provide a cash crop for farmers. And that's been very successful to date. The number of acres using those has continued to go up. Bowser, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, gets roughly half of the Clean Water Fund, which they distribute as grants and capacity funding, easements, and the like. They have an ever-increasing number of projects that have been funded that you see since the inception of the Clean Water Fund on the left. I think that map is going to be pretty green by the time the legacy amendment expires. But they deploy money through a PTM approach, where they prioritize projects based on all the science that's been developed through the Clean Water Fund and the other agencies. They target resources to the right places, and then they measure to see if it worked. Just one project that's emblematic of others, because there are dozens and dozens of projects that are like this around the state every year, is the Nemadji Watershed. For a $228,000 grant, they actually leveraged $9 million in other funds with the purpose of reconnecting streams within the watershed. You're going to hear a lot about culvert pipes in the years to come for a variety of reasons. It's something I had not considered as a liberal arts person, but if a culvert pipe like you see on the left is too high or too small to handle increased volumes because of higher rainfall due to climate change, you can, it's bad. If it's too high, you don't have enough fish passage or the other aquatic life required for fish to survive. It can cause pooling of some contaminants, and it just leads to more impairments. So if you have a continuous flow, it's good for aquatic life. In a high water, a culvert that's too small has too much volume coming in, it can lead to more erosion. And in the worst case scenario, it could lead to a blowout of the road, which leaves train car loads of sediment going downstream. So as new roads are designed and replaced, having the right culvert design or the right passage is really important. The DNR has a lot of expertise in this area as well in the design. But this case is reducing phosphorus loading by 379 pounds a year, which is phenomenal for any one project like that. And that's good for habitat as well. They have a 10-year goal in this watershed in, this is in Pine and Carlton counties, to connect all of the watershed's streams, to reconnect them. And they're already almost two-thirds of the way there just for that one project. But there are dozens more like this around the state every year. Bowser has also taken the lead on deploying more in cover crops. You've probably heard in the Environment Committee or the Ag Committee or one of the critical ways that we can reduce the existence of bare soil when cash crops aren't growing. They're kind of fickle. It depends on your soil type, your weather conditions and your location. And Polk County is not the same as Winona County, for example. So there has to be a lot of some trial and error, but there's a lot of science behind what works best where. But in order to convince landowners that they should do it, you need to have some demonstration sites where you can show people how it works. And so grants were made by Bowser using the Clean Water Fund to soil and water conservation districts in several diverse locations around the state to demonstrate that. That's certainly not the only example of cover crops. We support technical assistance in a variety of other ways to encourage cover crops, but that was a direct grant. Traverse County employed this. They have a goal of getting 1,800 acres in cover crops in Traverse County during their grant cycle, and they've already, as of September of last year, got 788 acres in cover crops, including 304 that are in those drinking water supply management areas, which is the zone surrounding wellhead area in a small town. And finally, the Minnesota Department of Health, they are charged with maintaining a safe drinking water. They have Sorry for all the numbers here, but there are 960 community public water systems in the state of Minnesota. Most of those use groundwater. I live in Shoreview in Ramsey County that uses groundwater. A town in rural Minnesota is going to use groundwater most of the time. Every one of those 960 communities needs a drinking water source protection plan to identify what needs to be done to protect that drinking water source for the foreseeable future. 88 of these plans were completed just in 2021. So we're now at 763 plans completed out of 960. So we're very close to completing those. And the State Department of Health will fund half of the budget requests from those municipalities for what's in those plans. Sometimes they are as small as a few thousand dollars. Even a generator, just to make sure a small town well keeps operating so that you don't have to boil your water if the power goes out. I found this out after the debacle in Texas when the city of Houston lost all their water, and the Department of Health says we actually helped prevent that, at least in small communities. The Department of Health also produces something like those RAPs, those blueprints, except they're for groundwater. They have completed 8 of these in the last year. That shows what needs to happen to protect and restore groundwater in a particular watershed. And then they have made grants to folks in some watersheds to let them know how they can help better protect their water. We do spend a lot of money in that technical assistance because not everybody knows what they need to do to manage the water in their area. We also have a contaminants of emerging concern program to identify unregulated contaminants in our water to see if there are any risks to human health. There have been some delays with COVID, with staff being transferred over to COVID, but they were able to get two contaminants to have health-based guidance. This is where you say you can't consume a certain percentage or certain amount per liter to be safe for everybody. Private well users, of which there are hundreds of thousands in the state, are always a concern to us, having safe water. The health department has worked with some local partners in the Southeast, as well as the western part of the state, to test out what messages and what techniques work to get people to test their own water on private property, and then to help them figure out what to do should they find out that their levels of arsenic or nitrate or manganese are too high, including getting some financial assistance. So that is a pilot program that is getting some results. We're going to get a presentation on that later this month at the council, but that's something that could be replicated elsewhere in the state. They've also produced at the health department a new stormwater reuse report. Stormwater reuse is really good for things like golf courses, like the Keller Golf Course. I know Hugo and Forest Lake use a lot of these where ball fields are irrigated with stormwater ponds. You harvest the rainwater. There can be some health risks at times, and so the health department put together some guidance for developers of those projects to make sure people don't get sick. And then finally, I know Representative Jordan has several lead-related bills. Thank you. And some of the data that's been presented in committee has been from a lead report that was instigated by the council after the situation in Flint, Michigan. And the council asked, what would it take to get rid of all lead out of our drinking water system in Minnesota? And the health department came up with a first of its kind study in the country to put the numbers on that, which has been really helpful for now when some federal money is coming our way. Almost finally, if you're at the Capitol, I hope you'll get a chance to go see the We Are Water exhibit. This is our where we dip into the humanities a little bit with the Clean Water Fund by empowering Minnesotans to protect our waters. That's one of the council's key strategic goals. This portable exhibit called We Are Water has been all around the state. I saw it in Pipestone, and it is really comprehensive and it's fun. This is not a skim milk version of environmental education. It's really helpful and it's useful for all ages. It's customized to the location where it's at. In Chisholm, they talked about issues related to northeastern Minnesota. In Pipestone, they had information related to the unique geology that they have in that part of the state. It's going on tour, starting in southeastern Minnesota to start, going all around the state and the locations there. But the thing that we really like about this at the council is that when people take a survey after they're done, 85% of people say they learned something new about their water, which is great because it says that we're not just preaching to the choir. Finally, last slide. So the Clean Water Council itself, we did take a field tour to southeastern Minnesota, where they have some unique challenges with drinking water. And it was really great to see how all the agencies work together. We have a lot of layers in water governance in Minnesota, and it's we really got to see how they all kind of fit together into a cohesive strategy. We're just about to start our recommendations process for the fiscal 24-25 biennium. We start early in March of this year, and we'll be done with a report to you by December. We are also asked in the House legacy, or the I guess it was the House position in the legacy finance appropriation, that we can complete a report on LIDAR and how LIDAR is used, because there was a sizable appropriation made in 2009 and 11. And we hadn't told you why LIDAR is important. And so that was requested. And so we completed that report to send it to the chairs. And if anyone else would like a copy, I'd be happy to share it. But I did want to mention the equity part here is the last item. Mr. Chair, I appreciate that the House has let us all know in state government this is really important to you, because we had been thinking about it in different ways, but you helped accelerate our thinking. We did have a subgroup of the council do some reflection on where we were or were not doing things to ensure that all Minnesotans have fishable, swimmable, and drinkable water. And we tried to identify barriers and gaps and areas where we're doing some things right. We came up with about a dozen items that we could identify right away where we were either doing something right or where there were gaps. Everything from immigrant communities often consuming more bottled water because their experience with tap water in their home countries was not very good. And so the city of Minneapolis told us that they're doing some education with immigrant communities about the safety of drinking water. We've heard about women landowners in greater Minnesota who don't do the farming. They're non-operating landowners, but we've been told by the university from survey results that sometimes women are not taken as seriously when it comes to getting technical assistance, and that's a problem. But we have engaged with tribal governments in many ways at the agency level, from planning and doing the science. Grand Portage has done a lot of great work at the Band of Ojibwe there on pharmaceutical detection. We've heard from the Prairie Island tribal chair on issues that have affected Prairie Island for many decades, and also had a presentation from the Indian Affairs Council. And we do have a tribal government representative on the council, but we need to do more. And to that end, we do have a small grants appropriation that you gave us for $1 million. And in putting the RFP for that together, which would be released after the start of the next fiscal year, we really wanted to make sure we had more people at the table to help get us clean water. And so that's one of the criteria we're looking at. It's written in a nice, you know, government style thing of how we would like to have some new voices trying to help us solve existing problems so we can accelerate our progress to clean water. So we haven't done quite the same level of outreach as Mr. Johnson has described, but that is our plan. There are many opportunities there. And actually, one of the ranking criteria in the draft RFP we have is that an area should be in an environmental justice area. And if you look at an environmental justice map of the state, for time, I won't share it, but it actually includes rural areas of the state too. And that's it, Mr. Chair.
We may have to have you back we really don't have much time for member questions. I really appreciate going over the efforts of the Clean Water Council. I appreciate all the work that you've done with collaboration, and I value, especially, following some of the work that Bowser's done with the working with willing farmers, and I didn't realize it was so many. I think you said over 1,000 producers. I mean, it's really amazing. We'll have to hear some from Representative Anderson. Sounds like he's an expert, so that's good.
I believe he may actually be presenting on the 22nd, if I'm not mistaken, because the program is going to do a little tie-in with the We Are Water exhibit at the Capitol on the 22nd. So.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Gardner, and please be available as you always are for questions. I had some questions about jobs. And I know a lot of the agencies are trying to hire minority folks and getting those folks. And so that was a story that I'd like to hear more about, because I was under the impression that that wasn't going on, but it sounds like you really are successful and making strong efforts. But again, thank you, members. I think we're kind of at the hour. Great presentations from the Lasard Sams folks and the Clean Water Council. Thank you all for your work, and please go back to your councils and tell them thank you for hearing what we're doing and listening to, you know, the legislature, kind of what's important, you know, our voices, and sounds like you are. So again, thank you. And with that, all members, we are adjourned. Thank you.